Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about this week Saudi Arabia cut back the supply of oil, driving the prices up at the pump. President Bush met with Saudi Ambassador Prince Bandar, apparently to no avail. We're looking into the Bush family's connections to the House of Saud with Craig Unger, the author of a new book, House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties. We'll talk about that later in the program. And then we'll also talk about The End of Oil, a new book by Paul Roberts, who covers resource issues for Harper's Magazine. He'll be talking to us about the broader issues of the monumental changes that will take place as oil is depleted, and it's no secret that we're behind the curve in terms of alternatives, but we're discussing that in the context of the Saudi driving the prices up and being the lead player in OPEC. And we'll start out talking about what happened in Fallujah this week. Fallujah, because the most rebellious town in the so-called Sunni Triangle. We'll be talking in a moment with Barry Yeoman, who has an article in Mother Jones, Soldiers of Good Fortune, that can be accessed at motherjones.com. He also had an opinion piece in Friday's New York Times, Need an Army, Just Pick Up the Phone. We'll be talking to Barry in a moment about the privatization of national security and some of these private contractors, including Blackwater, where the three Americans that were killed in Fallujah came from. I'm speaking with Barry Yeoman, who has been following the privatization of national security in terms of private contractors. And as I mentioned, Barry's got an article in Mother Jones, motherjones.com, Soldiers of Good Fortune, and in Friday's New York Times, Need an Army, Just Pick Up the Phone. Barry, it seems that these four, the three soldiers that were, mercenaries that were killed a week ago in Fallujah, I mean, I've been reading their bios. They were all incredibly, you know, the cream of the special forces, the so-called snake eaters. So it's pretty hard to understand how the best of U.S. special forces could have been caught so flat-footed.
Well, there are two things which are hard to really understand. One is that I think that a part of the explanation is that Blackwater really prides itself in going into the most perilous situations. They do have the most highly trained soldiers who are former Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, Green Berets, but they're proud of taking risks. That is what makes them different from the larger private military firms, which have much less specialized forces. That might be one of the explanations. But I also have to say that one thing that has surprised me is that this has received so much attention, because one reason we hire contractors is to keep things under the radar screen so the public is not aware of it. If this happened to four soldiers, you know there would be an even bigger outcry. Normally, when things happen to contractors, and we have lost 50 contractors, not only these four, it tends to have no press at all. And that's the very reason we've been trying to shift from soldiers to contractors for non-weapons firing functions.
Well, of course, it also escapes congressional oversight, not to mention public outcry about our boys and girls getting killed. I mean, there is an effort on the part of the Bush administration to privatize aggressively, and apparently they're, as the National Guardsmen leave Iraq, they are often recruited by these private companies. You mentioned that 50 have been killed so far. We only heard about these three in Fallujah. The other 47 passed unnoticed. 20, I believe 20 or so have been killed in Colombia, where
right.
We've been using these mercenaries for some time. And And you, in your article in the New York Times, you mentioned that you spent some time with the head of Blackwater, the company that employed these three that were killed in Fallujah. Isn't this Blackwater operation pretty state of the art? I mean, I think they're training some of the regular military, aren't they?
I spent a day at Blackwater last year, and there were busloads of soldiers who were being bussed in for very sophisticated training in both urban warfare. They've got a little city block set up to train people in how to fight in the streets of a city. They also do extensive training in how to take on people who attack your ship. So if you're a sailor and you're at sea in a war zone and a bunch of terrorists come on, that was actually the big thing that they were training that day. They've trained something like 50,000 people, not all military, part military, part law enforcement, but a lot of them have been soldiers. We used to say that you need a soldier to train a soldier. That's why we have a military. Historically, we thought of contractors as being people who serve dinner or who build barracks or who do really non-combat related things. But what's happening at Blackwater, and it's happening elsewhere too, is they've been moving into more combat related functions. I talked to Gary Jackson, who is Blackwater's president. He said that his goal is to create the best trained and largest private army in the world.
Courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer.
Right. Well, he was actually picturing it courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer and the French taxpayer and the British taxpayer and so on.
Uh-huh.
He was hoping that if there's a peacekeeping operation in some country and France is told that they need to send in 200 soldiers, that rather than doing something very unpopular and sending in 2,000 of their men and women, that they would simply phone Blackwater and say, we need 200 people in this country next week.
Well, of course, the French sort of, in effect, created the model with the Foreign Legion, the Légion Étrangère, which is where they get people from around the world who are stateless and essentially expendable. I take it Blackwater's also been training Chilean commandos.
Who were
set up by the dictator of Pinochet. They're going to be serving in Iraq. They've got the Gurkhas. The British have brought the Gurkhas in, and the Fijians apparently are there as well. The Bulgarians, no, the Romanians are coming in large numbers. So what percentage of the coalition is private?
Roughly 10%.
Which is bigger than the British contingency then?
Yes. Back in 1990-91, when we were in the first Gulf War, we had roughly one private contractor per 100 soldiers. Now we have one contractor per 10 soldiers. Very big difference. And increasingly, the contractors are performing jobs for which they are essential. That is, you can't fight a war if you don't have them now. So they are fixing weapon systems. They are operating weapon systems. They are providing very essential security. They are no longer simply in support functions, but rather moving toward the core, although not at the technical core, which has all sorts of worrisome implications, one of which is if you have contractors who are doing things that we need, such as operating weapon systems, and they leave, there's nothing to stop. If a soldier leaves, he's court-martialed. If an entire contracting firm says, whoa, this is too dangerous, there's nothing to stop them. They would be sued for a breach of contract, but that's not a big deal to them.
These guys are getting well paid, though, aren't they?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, isn't that the whole point, that the taxpayer is getting ripped off? We're paying for this for the regular guys. We're paying for the National Guardsmen who take tremendous financial hardship to do what they do. But then we're paying this huge premium for these guys. I mean, they're recruiting shooters from the special forces to be mercenaries in Iraq, paying them $1,000 a day.
Right.
I mean, if they're prepared to pay guys at the shooter level, you better believe that at the executive level, the trickle-down economics is just humongous. And apparently we're talking about $100 billion worth of taxpayers' money gone into this privatized national security phenomenon.
Yes, that's true. That still might not be enough to keep somebody there if their life is in imminent danger. And that's a really scary prospect.
Well, I know, for example, and you mentioned this in your article, that DynCorp, which is here in Los Angeles area in Torrance, they were implicated in a sex trafficking scandal, some of their men in Bosnia, where they've been serving, involving girls as young as 12. And, of course, had these soldiers been U.S. military, they would have been court-martialed. But as private contractors, they just got on the next plane back to America. So.
Right.
I mean, it's again, this brings up the notion of oversight, you know, that I thought the Founding Fathers made it the primary function of the government was for national security. And now we have a phenomenon that is free of government scrutiny, it appears, and is below the radar in terms of the press. In terms of casualties.
Right. The hiring of private contractors is specifically for the purpose of not having accountability. We notice that contractors are sent into places where it is either highly unpopular to send soldiers or actually illegal to send soldiers. So, for example, the law says we can't send soldiers to train armies unless they're certified free of human rights abuses. Well, most of the divisions of the Army in Colombia have not been certified because they've committed terrible abuses. There's nothing in the law that says that we have to stop these mercenaries from training soldiers. So the Army in some repressive country just needs to pick up the phone and make a phone call to a private company, and there's virtually nothing to stop them. They do need a permit from the State Department, but those permits have been issued.
Well, there's also the example in the Balkan War. I mean, it's not well understood in this country that what helped defeat Milosevic and the Serbs in the Yugoslav, former Yugoslavian wars, starting with Croatia and then Bosnia and then finally Kosovo, was that the United States secretly armed Croatia. They used Argentina as a cutout. And that crook that bankrupted Argentina, Carlos Menem, was given our seal of approval to go out and raise multilateral loans, which he squandered and stole and led to the bankruptcy. That was his reward. But also, because there were UN sanctions equally against Serbia and Croatia, the U.S. busted the sanctions by sending in private military contractors to train the Croatian army.
Right. We knew that the president of Croatia was a terrible despot, but he was our despot. And while we couldn't send in our resources, we could give a license to a private company to go there as long as the training was not strategic warfare training. Now, they claim it wasn't, but it so happens that very shortly afterwards, there was an army victory that was very, very NATO-like that could not have happened 6 months earlier. And the only explanation is that a private military firm that was supposed to be in there training them in how to have a more democratic military, in fact, was teaching them how to launch NATO-style warfare.
And just to touch on some of the how pervasive this new phenomenon of private military is. I mean, the people that guard Karzai are the Afghan's president are private contracts. The people that guard Paul Bremer, the head of the coalition authority, that's Blackwater, does
right.
it?
Right. Yeah. Right.
So, I mean, as far as I know, there's only that one congresswoman, Jan Schatowski, I think her name is. She's the only person in the Congress that's raising alarms about this. I mean, what the hell's wrong with these people?
She has been the most audible. There have not been many others. And in fact, there's a law that says that you only need to report private military contracts to Congress if they're over a certain threshold. I think it's $100 million. And there are many contracts that are $50 million or $10 million that don't even have to be reported. And I suspect that Congress wants it that way, that they realize that there is a strategic purpose to have military firms that are not as accountable. Plus, these firms have a lot of credibility in Capitol Hill because not only are they fairly major campaign donors, but also they're often headed by people who have impressive military experience. So they can say that it's in the country's best interest to allow increasing levels of penetration into armed conflict by their firms. What they don't say is that they're not lobbying because they think it's in the best military interest of the country, but rather because they want to make money.
Well, that's what goes on in Washington. Money is recycled.
Right.
You know, taxpayers' money goes to contractors, and then they cycle it back to the Congress in the form of campaign donations.
Yeah. If you have a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry or the gambling industry, or banking or whatever, he might couch his argument or her argument in terms of national interest, but everybody knows it's about profit. The thing about the lobbying that happens by military firms is that these guys have a lot of cred. They're very believable. And so people in Congress seem to receive their arguments with a special level of deference that isn't given to other lobbyists.
Well, just in closing then, Barry Yeoman, the Pentagon claims that these private contractors are what they call force multipliers, and that that Iraq is there's three concentric circles of protection there. There's the outer circle of the newly trained Iraqi police, many of whom are pretty duplicitous. Then you have the contractors, and then you have the U.S. military. And, of course, all of these people are hunkered down, essentially. I don't see how the hell you could build a nation if you hunkered down behind razor wire. But the bottom line is that it's not really a case of these people being force multipliers. They're also trigger pullers, and they're taking a larger and larger role. So, can you foresee a day where the private mercenaries will be replacing the U.S. professional military?
I think that they're going to be approaching those core combat functions more and more and more. Who knows if they will actually be pulling the triggers, but we have certainly seen cases of them already pulling triggers, even if they're not supposed to. And I think that the line will be ever more blurry.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los
My
Angeles,
pleasure.
Barry Yeoman. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've just speaking there with Barry Yeoman, who has written an article for Mother Jones, which is at motherjones.com, Soldiers of Good Fortune, and he also had an op-ed piece in Friday's New York Times, Need an Army, Just Pick Up the Phone. And I'm now speaking with Paul Roberts, who covers resource issues for Harper's Magazine. He's the author of a forthcoming book, The End of Oil. And this week, Paul, Saudi Arabia cut its supply, forcing OPEC to follow suit, since they're the biggest player in OPEC, thus driving up prices at the pump. President Bush met with Prince Bandar, and in spite of the special relationship between the House of Bush and the House of Saud, which we'll be covering later in the program, apparently to no avail. So give me a sense of the politics behind this, and also, why is it that Saudi Arabia, our friend, is doing this to us?
Well, the Bush administration is in a tough spot because they have consumers and potential voters screaming bloody murder about high gasoline prices and really misapprehending how the market works, and so expecting that the Bush administration or somebody can pull a switch somewhere or turn on a faucet and bring gasoline prices down. And so When consumers read that OPEC is cutting production, it feels like a twisting the knife in the wound. But the Bush administration knows there's a couple things going on. In the short term, OPEC looks at the market and says, you know, prices are high, but really what's going to happen here in a few weeks is the prices are going to come down. And the reason is because, while no one's really been paying attention, Americans have been importing so much oil that there's actually a glut of oil in America. And a glut means that prices will fall. And the Saudis know from painful experience that if prices begin to fall of their own accord, they can actually bottom out. And if what happens is, you know, if we convince the Saudis to produce more oil to bring prices down at the same time there was already a glut building, then there would be these kind of two vectors pushing prices down, and the Saudis could see the prices go from, you know, the mid-30s, $35 a barrel where they are now, down to, you know, $8 or $10 a barrel, which has happened to them before, and it's just murder on their bottom line. So they're hoping now is if they cut a little bit, take some of the slack out of the market, they can engineer what they call a soft landing. Now that's the you know what the businessman sees, the consumer sees that those wicked Saudis are again, you know, holding America over a barrel, so to speak, and so the Bush administration essentially has to speak out of both sides of its mouth, you know, having promised in the campaign, the Bush administration promised it was going to lean on the Saudis and lean on OPEC and really flex American muscles and make sure that, you know, OPEC behaved itself, and yet now, like every president, you know, for the last century, the Bush administration realizes that there's only so much that they can do.
Well, of course, interesting enough, the Bush administration, I mean, the Bush re-election campaign are running commercials lampooning Kerry for allegedly wanting to raise taxes and specifically raise gas taxes.
Right.
And, I mean, that's the reason why we have a dysfunctional and out of control. We're all in denial. Nothing is really being done about energy. And you've written a book, The End of Oil. So the shock is coming. And I take it the dynamics of the denial, and it's worth noting, that, by the way, that even at the high prices we have now at the pump, people are still buying SUVs, and the biggest sellers are these F-100 pickup trucks that Ford depends on so much.
Right.
So there's denial there. But the political mechanics are such that no politician, whether he's a Democrat or a Republican, can raise the price of oil like they do in Europe. They simply can't do it.
It's a great point. It's, you know, John Kerry is suffering for even having supported an idea without even voting for it 10 years ago, and the Bush administration knows that in this environment of high gas prices and outraged motorists, that to even, you know, to hear that a politician even thought about a gas tax 10 years ago is enough to hurt him politically. So Kerry is having to retreat and really maybe rethink the way that his campaign is looking at energy. And this goes to the larger question which you just brought out, and that is that the American consumer has the most absurd and retarded concept of energy. I mean, really, one of my goals in my book was to kind of help move Americans out of what I call energy illiteracy. We're like Homer Simpson when it comes to gasoline and how we misapprehend how it works. Basically, American consumer's idea of energy is a hodgepodge of slogans. And they're slogans like, you know, gasoline should never go over $1.50 a barrel, and Americans, it's in the Constitution somewhere that we have a right to cheap energy. And, you know, when gas prices rise, it's the oil companies and it's Arabs and OPEC that are doing it to us. And never is it brought up that it's our own consumption, our rapidly rising consumption, and the pinch that puts on the markets that drives price as much as anything. And politicians know that if they're going to, so they know going into it, that to even touch the energy issue is like it's what they call a third rail issue in politics. You can get electrocuted and just fried. And they know that, you know, that what they have to, if someone like Kerry, if he even wants to talk about energy, and you notice the Bush administration is really shying away from it except to criticize Kerry. But the Kerry administration, or the Kerry campaign, hopes to be an administration, they thought that energy would be a smart issue to pick up on because high gas prices and gee, it's something that America really needs to address. And what they quickly discover is that, you know, you have to, on the one hand, it's a balancing act, because you have to, on the one hand, alert consumers that there is a problem, that the energy system that we depend on is in a state of slow motion collapse. It's not just oil, it's natural gas, it's electricity, and it's kind of heading toward this collapse that everyone at the policy level can see. So on the one hand, you have to really raise the alarm, but the other hand, you don't want to suggest, even hint, that Americans will have to maybe pay more for gasoline or drive smaller cars or live in houses that are kept a little bit cooler or basically live like a European, because Americans, the idea is repugnant to them. It feels like they're having to go back to the 70s and wear sweaters and you know, they're very much enjoying the notion of being able to drive as much as they want in whatever car they want, and really continue in a state of denial. So you're exactly right.
Well, it seems so that the crunch is coming, and it's coming a lot faster than people think. And there are several factors for it, which your forthcoming book, The End of Oil, deals with. And I mean, not the least of which is that China and India are coming online, and their demand is going up. It's worth noting that in China, for example, more roads are built every year in China than exist in all of France. So it's happening, and yet we've reached the point where we're past the point of no return, haven't we? In terms of at least availability, I don't know. In terms of exploration, I don't think there's much. And it's worth noting too that Shell recently had to downgrade its inventory twice. So we don't even have what we thought we have.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that even though there's a great deal of oil left to be found, the challenge is now getting to it. It's either locked away in some, you know, geologically obscure spot, like, you know, up in the tundra, the Siberian tundra, or it's locked away in OPEC. And in both cases, it's tougher and tougher to get at. So on the one hand, you have an increasing challenge of finding more oil and keeping your production up. And on the other side of the equation, you have, like you point out, China and India are surprising everyone at how quickly they're growing. Growing economies need energy, especially oil. You know, China has looked at America for the last 50 years in a state of envy. They've admired our economic growth, and particularly our automotive industry, which they see as a pillar to economic growth. They see all the jobs it created, they see the wealth it generated, and they see we're going to do that too. And they want not only to make automobiles, but as you point out, with the roads they're building, they want Chinese to drive them. And that means, you know, a huge uptick in their demand for oil. And like America, China can't produce enough oil at home. It has to import. You know, the Chinese are not idiots. They understand that if they're going to grow, you know, have a gigantic car industry, they're going to need to promote efficiency. They seem to understand it better than we do. And so they've passed laws, or in the process of passing regulations that will require new Chinese cars to have pretty tough, pretty high fuel efficiency. To meet fuel efficiency standards, but even so, even if they were to cut their fuel requirements in half, it's still a great deal of fuel they'll need. And so this is putting an additional strain on a market, an oil market that was already under strain. And so, you know, I think for any number of reasons, any number of angles that you look at it, the energy system is approaching a point of exhaustion.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Paul Roberts, who covers resource issues for Harper's Magazine, the author of a forthcoming book, The End of Oil. Now, we talked about the U.S. consumer's denial about this is a resource that is being depleted, that is not infinite, and at some point or other, you're going to have to make some kind of adjustments. But it's politically impossible for any politician to deal with this thing realistically and to start imposing taxes, which could then be used to invest in alternatives. But the other delusion that seems to be fairly prevalent is that a lot of people think that the reason we're in the Middle East, and particularly now in Iraq, is that somehow we're doing everybody else a favor, because Europe depends upon all the oil out of the Middle East more than we do, and the Chinese and the Japanese are completely vulnerable and dependent upon Middle East oil. But isn't it obvious that the reason that the United States is in there trying to guarantee and maintain the access to the world's largest reserves of energy is that it gives the United States some leverage over these countries, particularly China and Japan? If we control their economic lifeline, that gives us some clout, doesn't it?
Well, that's certainly been the kind of an argument of that what we're looking at is the kind of the opening moves in a new Cold War between China and the U.S. You know, China has its eyes on the Middle East as intently as we ever have, and so that's clearly going to be flavoring the geopolitical atmosphere for the next 20 years. We're clearly seeing the beginnings of it, but I think that whenever I hear people talk about an oil war, you know, I say to myself, Of course it is. What else could it be? And it's not that it's an oil company conspiracy, and it's not that there's a bunch of oil executives who work in the White House now. You know, the fact of the matter is that given that the U.S. uses as much oil as it does and has done absolutely nothing, you know, substantively to curb our demand, And given that our economy and the economy of all our trading partners depends so heavily on oil, and given that most of the world's oil, you know, today and in the future, resides in the Middle East, and given finally that that region is unstable and was threatened very much by Saddam Hussein, I mean, you know, if the idea that we weren't in there for oil would be absurd. You know, I mean, as recently as August of 2002, Vice President Dick Cheney was willing to say publicly during speeches, you know, to business groups that one of the White House's main concerns about Saddam Hussein getting weapons of mass destruction was that he would further destabilize the most important oil region in the world. And it was a kind of a flash of honesty. It was essentially the Vice President was saying, look, we use a lot of oil. It's important to us. Why wouldn't we be concerned? I mean, it was kind of how weapons of mass destruction and oil come together logically. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's kind of a fact of geopolitical life. A couple months later, the White House rethought itself and said, that may not be the smartest thing to be saying in public, Dick. So let's change our tune. And then you had the spectacle of Defense Secretary Rumsfeld answering a question about American interest in Iraqi oil by saying, oh, no. The war in Iraq has nothing to do with oil, you know, as if it was absurd to even ask the question. So we've gone from being almost brutally too honest to, you know, maintaining this really cartoon-like fiction. But again, it's not useful to look at it as some sort of a massive industry conspiracy. It's more, this is what the world runs on, oil. And he who controls it, as it's been, you know, for the last century, really has a handle on geopolitical power.
Well, of course, the other cold shower here is that this reverse domino theory of bringing democracy to the Middle East via Iraq is not working. So, if it was a part of a plan to take over Iraq's oil and to dominate the Middle East to guarantee the oil supply, it seems that at least so far things aren't going well in Iraq.
Well, no, and I think that, you know, anything that made the region stable, I mean, I think a lot of Bush administration officials and certainly predecessors in the Clinton White House have long felt that a stable democratic region would naturally be inclined to sell its oil to the West. I mean, why wouldn't they? I mean, everyone likes to make money. Iraq's got a lot of oil. It should be a win-win-win-win situation, you know, like and I think they're really disappointed that the Iraqis don't see it that way. And certainly, Iraq has a great many problems, and its situation is far more complex than anyone in America imagined. And so, true, the plan to unleash a tidal wave of Iraqi oil hasn't come through, but it doesn't take away from the larger focus. America's energy focus has been on supply for so long. You were pointing out we've always felt the answer really was to either, you know, strong arm OPEC into giving us more oil, or to, you know, develop oil alliances with countries like Russia and Nigeria, and therefore, you know, diversify our portfolio of foreign suppliers. But again, always focusing on more supply. That was the basis of U.S. energy security. And the truth of the matter is that you really can't control supply. If you're having to rely on foreign suppliers, and if most of the oil is in unstable regions, you're guaranteeing disruption.
But when are they going to bite the bullet about the obvious thing, which is that you've got to stop thinking about supply and start thinking about alternatives?
Or demand. Well, really what you're saying is when demand.
Right. Because that's the first thing that anybody that knows anything about energy says, the first thing we can do is conserve because we're so profligate. So
right.
You can do demand, but you've also got to start thinking about all the alternatives. And now the Bush people have come up with the hydrogen, which was a clever public relations gimmick, but it's a long way off.
It's decades off.
And in the meantime, there's a whole bunch of steps that can be taken right away. There's biodiesel, there's the hybrids, the electric drive turns out to be the best way to run a car at any rate. Where's this, just in the last minute or so, Paul Roberts, where's this stimulus going to come from? You'd think that the average American could, they must viscerally somewhere get the idea that we're giving money to people who want to kill us. At the same time, every time we turn on our automobile, we create global warming and change the climate, and that's going to kill us in the end.
Well, you know, we've already talked about how consumers have a kind of absurd and unrealistic view of energy, and I think a lot of American policymakers do in a different way, and that is that before they move to a new technology, they want it to be perfect. And you know, the old adage, the perfect is the enemy of the good, it's classically illustrated here. What we need now is to not delay changing until we have a perfect hydrogen fuel cell, because it may never show up. We need things that begin cutting demand right away. And what's interesting is it hasn't been a government program that's done that. It's been the Japanese with what? The gas-electric hybrid. This is a technology it uses kind of existing technologies and pushes it. It uses, more importantly, an existing fuel structure. We don't have to build new refineries. It cuts fuel use in half. It cuts emissions in half. And again, it essentially allows motorists, once it gets going, to have their old big car, you know, and use less power. So it's what we call a bridge technology. It gets us, it halts demand, or at least slows it, and gives us some breathing room to develop a new technology. It cuts demand overall so that by the time, 20 years from now, when we do bring on fuel cells or whatever it is, the total demand isn't so high that we don't have any hope at all.
And what about public transportation? I mean, they've just passed a transportation bill in the House.
Right.
The Senate's going to ask for more. Bush is promising to veto it. It's absolutely pork-laden. I mean, is the problem that the lobbying system in Washington it guarantees that American capitalists and big companies like the auto companies are just guarantees their inertia? Because, I mean, he got Andy Card, the chief of staff of the White House, former lobbyist for General Motors. They seem to spend all their time lobbying the Congress not to do anything. Meanwhile, the Japanese, every Honda car that just comes off the assembly line, it reaches the PZEV mandate here in California.
That's right. Well, the Japanese figured out a long time ago, look, this works, let's do it. The Americans aren't, so hey. But I think that the whole thing about mass transit, I mean, it has such a great sound to it. We all think that in the future, somehow, someone like us, our neighbor maybe, will be happy to ride the bus, but most of us aren't. And it turns out that if you look at developing countries, as soon as people can afford cars, they get the heck off the bus. People hate buses. And this doesn't mean that we don't promote mass transit, but we need to look at it realistically and understand that people equate buses with backwardness. They think they have to take them now. There are certainly folks who like to read on the bus or read on the train or are happy not to deal with traffic, but in a strange way, people equate development and progress with having a car, and it's a tough habit to break. And I think what it means is that although you keep mass transit as an option, a viable option, you focus on that instrument which consumers seem to be so intent on holding on to, which is the car. And again, we look at hybrids, we look at biodiesel, we look at ways to make what we're using more efficient. And it goes back to a larger question, which is look at what's right in front of you. You know, just to get out of denial. Policymakers and analysts need to get out of denial too. They need to stop pretending that Americans and other consumers in developed countries love their cars. You know, this is why we're seeing big cars showing up in Europe. You know, this image of the Europeans living the right way is fading because they want big cars too. We're going to see them in Japan. You know, it's what people, it has as much to do with style and personal preference as anything
else. But it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. You can still have a big car if it's for a hybrid. You know, we set up this false dichotomy between the road warriors and the eco warriors.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a dangerous, I'm being a little bit of a devil's advocate here, because the fact of the matter is that maybe at some point we need to start adjusting our thinking, but the government certainly isn't going to be able to do that. I mean, we resist that more than anything else, social engineering. And so, you know, at some point, as someone pointed out to me, the environment doesn't care about miles per gallon. It cares about gallons, all right? And at some point, it won't matter how efficient our cars are. There'll be too many of them.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Paul Roberts.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Paul Roberts, who covers resource issues for Harper's Magazine and has a forthcoming book, The End of Oil. I'm now speaking with Craig Unger, who is the author of a new book, A House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties. And Craig, you've covered both Bushes for The New Yorker and Vanity Fair. This week, the Saudis cut their supply, thus driving up prices at the pump. They basically are the main player in OPEC. Prince Bandar went to the White House. So what happened to this special relationship? Because as far as I can tell, the U.S. Consumer is getting stiffed.
Right. Well, not every relationship ends well. Some end in divorce, actually. And this one was having problems even before 9/11. The Saudis were very, very angry at George W. Bush over his failure to do anything with the Middle East peace process. And even back then, in the summer of 2001, things were so bad that Crown Prince Abdullah, who, of course, is the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, called George Bush Sr. and had a sort of man-to-man talk with him and said, what's going on with your son? You've got to intercede and get your son on board with the Middle East peace process. And things only started to get better, actually. Ironically, it was September 10th that Prince Bandar felt that he'd really patched things up, and George Bush had written a letter to Crown Prince Abdullah saying, doing a complete about-face, and everything was patched up. And finally, Prince Bandar went back to his mansion in McLean, Virginia, and was smoking a cigar in his indoor swimming pool, thinking the relationship was just fine, and that was September 10th, 2001. Bush has done favors for the Saudis since then, I think principally allowing them to get out of the country when airspace was shut down. But I think that relationship is not going to help out consumers who are worried about paying too much gas. And there's several reasons for this. One is the Saudis are still angry over the U.S. failure to do anything with the U.S. peace talks. Another is the Iraq
war. You mean the
war.
Palestinian-Israeli peace talks?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Things are worse there than they've been in years, and they're certainly no closer to a solution. The peace process has been completely derailed. But the Iraq war is another obstacle. The Saudi, in many ways, George Bush fulfilled the prophecy of Osama bin Laden, who was saying the Americans are effectively crusaders, and they will be sending troops to an oil-rich They will be invading an oil-rich Arab country very soon, and we have to fight them. And in fact, President Bush fulfilled that prophecy. So domestically, the Saudis, the royal ruling family, do not want to be seen as doing any favors for Americans. I mean, it would only hurt them. In addition, the Saudis have their own internal problems and their own economic problems. Their per capita income has dropped dramatically. A generation ago, the average Saudi was nearly as rich as the average American. Since then, the per capita income has dropped by about 70%, and now it's only around $8,000 a person. And there's this huge growing disparity between the extraordinary wealth of the ruling family and the average person, and there's enormous unemployment. And one way to help solve the economic problems is by jacking up the price of oil.
Well, but when you talk about the House of Saud, you're talking about a dysfunctional family. They're hardly all singing from the same hymnal. You've got the Crown Prince. First of all, the head of state is effectively a vegetable. His entree to him is controlled by his wife and the youngest son, Azuzi, who's apparently a disgraceful creature, who built a $5 billion house for himself and who's been giving money to Al-Qaeda. You've got the interior minister, and the Sidaris brothers from the favorite wife of the founder, and you've got these sort of the so-called nominally pro-Western wing with Bandar and the defense minister, what's his name?
Sultan,
yeah.
Bandar's father.
Yeah, that they're supposed to be pro-Western, but, you know, who knows whether any of these people are really pro-Western.
You've got Naif,
who replaced Prince Turki, who was in charge of their CIA. He was effectively bin Laden's case officer, one of his mentors. And Naif, I take it, in your book you suggest that if there's going to be a coup inside Saudi Arabia, it won't necessarily be bin Laden who takes over, it'll be Naif.
Right. There's an enormous amount of civil unrest. People have been predicting the demise of the House of Saud for years, but it could well take place in the form of a shift within the royal family that where someone like Prince Nayef or someone closer to the militant clerics takes over.
Well, I mean,
and that does not bode well for us. I mean, if there are for all the problems with the ruling family as it now stands, whoever replaces them is likely to be more anti-American.
But what about the point that I'm getting at, which is that the royals have this duplicitous relationship with the Wahhabi sect, who control the country internally. So, you know, they all have their money abroad and they have all their hookers and their yachts and their palaces, etc. But then they have this external piety at home. So where does this duplicity play out in terms of what's really in their hearts and minds vis-a-vis their relationship to the United States? I mean, think about this guy, Prince Ahmed bin Salman, who we saw in Kentucky with his racehorses, etc. He was one of the main guys that they got out on these planes after 9/11. In fact, on his own personal luxury 727, they flew all around this country when every plane was grounded. They picked this guy up. He gets out. It turns out that he knew about 9/11 prior to when it happened. And I guess the Saudi royals took care of him because he mysteriously died shortly thereafter.
That's right. He had a heart attack at the age of 43.
But what does that say, though? I mean, if one of the top guys in the House of Saud is actually, funneling money to Al-Qaeda, knows that they're about to strike the United States, and he's over here buying racehorses. At the same time, Bin Laden's boys are getting ready to get on the planes. I mean, hello.
Right. Well, they've always been playing a double game, and I think the same might be said of the Bush White House. And I suspect that this will become a big issue during in the upcoming presidential race, because back in 2000, George Bush had said while he was campaigning, and I'll quote: "What I think the president ought to do is he ought to get on the phone with the OPEC cartel and say we expect you to open your spigots." And, of course, he has not done that now that OPEC is jacking up the price of oil. And what you have is a situation, and I think the Democrats are going to be making some hay over this, where privately the Bush administration has made a lot of money from the Saudis. As I show in my book, over $1.4 billion has gone from Saudi royalty, from the in investments and contracts, into companies in which Bush and his allies have had a major position. Among them, of course, is Dick Cheney at Halliburton, and Cheney personally made $34 million in his last year at Halliburton. And Halliburton got a lot of Saudi contracts, and yet they're not doing anything to cut down.
Now, the Saudis underwrite the Carlyle Group that George Bush Sr. is a part of, along with Carlucci and all of these former top defense officials in the United States?
Right. I found at least $80 million had gone from the Saudi royal family and their allies into the Carlyle Group. And then over $1.4 billion in contracts, or rather $1.2 billion in contracts.
And wasn't it also true that it was a Saudi who bailed out George W. Bush in his failed company Harkin when they got a dry well, the price is about to drop, and mysterious benefactor came in to stabilize the price?
Right. That was the case in the late 80s and in 1990. Again, Bush's father was president at the time. And Harkin Energy was this struggling oil company on the verge of bankruptcy. And suddenly, four sets of people, all of whom were connected to the Saudis, started putting in money and bailing out Harkin Energy. So the Saudis have sought this political influence again and again, and the Bushes have profited from it. But right now, I think you're going to see the price of oil could well go up. People are saying $3 a gallon.
Well, but it apparently, according to our prior guest, there is actually a glut in the pipeline. So I suspect that before the election in the fall, the prices will go way down. I mean, these guys will do anything to get reelected, I guarantee you.
Right. I think
there's something will happen with Cuba in Florida. I mean, there's a lot of options that they have, and I'm sure that they'll pull out all the stops.
It'll be very interesting. I think there's so many combustible elements that are in the works, and I can see them all coming together around September.
But how's, just to put yourself in the position of Kerry, how's he going to get this issue out? Because let's face it, under the Clintons, it's the same relationship. I mean, there's no question that the House of Bush and the House of Saud have relationships, and they have business relationships, and you've outlined them in your book. How are they going to one, deal with the energy gouging? After all, but George W. Bush's biggest benefactor in his entire political career turned out to be a mega crook from an energy gouging company, Enron. So, I mean, it's all out there, but I don't see the Democrats making a coherent case.
Well, I think the material's there, and they should start making it. I think there's a lot of issues there. One is just the favor. The Saudis played a key role in 9/11, and that's important. Yet the Bushes rewarded them by flying key Saudi family members out of the United States just after 9/11,
including one of the guys that knew about 9/11 before it happened.
Right, and I mean that. I would be surprised. We'll see if that becomes an issue. The Bush administration redacted 28 pages of key material regarding Saudi Arabia's role in the September in a congressional report about that. Bush was hosting Prince Bandar and his wife. Just afterwards, it became apparent that they had given money directly to a Saudi, or rather indirectly to some of the hijackers. Another issue will be Cheney. He's profited enormously. He still owns over 400,000 stock options in Halliburton. So he's done very well because of his Saudi relationships. James Baker is defending the Saudis against the families of 9/11. I mean, again and again, it seems that you have. The current administration is saying they're the big, they're the only one you can trust on national security, but when they've had to make choices, they tend to side with the Saudis, even against the families of 9/11.
So is this? I mean, why do the Saudis make these sweetheart deals with the Bush family? I mean, I understand for the longest time there's been an effort to recycle petrodollars. That's why we dump so much military equipment on it. And, of course, they use that, the Saudis internally use that as a way to to skim and pay themselves off from these contracts.
Saudis know how political influence work, and they came here over 30 years ago looking to strike up relationships with powerful politicians. They did it on both the Democratic and the Republican side. And you may recall back in the 70s, Clark Clifford, who was Secretary of Defense, and Burt Lance, who was in the Carter administration, both sort of had their careers ruined as a result of their relationship with the Saudis. With the Bushes, they've had a longer, richer, and more complicated relationship, and they've done it in a more sophisticated way through murky third-party relationships, through offshore companies in the Cayman Islands, through Swiss banks, and so on.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Craig Unger, but I thank you very much for joining us and for your new book, House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationships Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Craig Unger, who has covered both of the Bushes for New Yorker and Vanity Fair, and he's the author of this new book, House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties. I thank Mark Mackles, the engineer, and Louis Vandenberg for research and producing this program.